passageway too narrow to be called an alley, they watched a dozen stormtroopers pass through an intersection. Cassian recognized a side street across the way. "That should bring us out of the quarter," he said. Jin waited for the patrol to move on, then promptly sprinted through the crossroads. Cassian and K2 followed, only to stumble to a halt as Jin abruptly stopped. Blocking the side street, nested in a pile of rubble, was the dusty wreck of an X-Wing starfighter. Cassian swore. It wouldn't be difficult to climb across, but it would leave them exposed for precious seconds.
"Halt! Stop right there!"
The trio turned together toward the voice. The stormtroopers who'd passed by were now spread out to block their retreat. Too many to fight, Cassian thought, and his hand drifted to his blaster anyway. His power pack was almost empty, but there was no point in saving his bolts. Jin's shoulders sagged, yet she stared at the stormtroopers like she was eager to enter the fray, glad to have nowhere to run. The squad leader nodded to K2SO.
"Where are you taking these prisoners?"
Cassian felt something very similar to hope. The droid stared back at the squad leader as if struggling to process a response.
"These are prisoners."
Cassian winced. The feeling like hope evaporated. He flicked through a deck of possibilities. Maybe K2 was trying to access Imperial behavioral programming and coming up short. Maybe overridden Imperial loyalty protocols were coming back to life, thanks to hardware damage or some personal memory of the squad leader. Most likely, and worst of all, K2 was that bad at lying. He always had been, since the reprogram. Relentless honesty was his natural state.
"Yes?"
the squad leader said.
"Where are you taking the prisoners?"
"I am taking them,"
K2 spoke with stilted care,
"to imprison them. In prison."
Cassian channeled his irritation into a growl of anger, a sound he prayed resembled something a defiant captive might make.
"He's taking us to—"
The droid swung a metal arm into Cassian's face.
"Quiet!"
The blow nearly took Cassian off his feet and left his nose and chin throbbing painfully, his lips stinging. K2 loomed over him.
"And there's a fresh one if you mouth off again."
"We'll take them from here,"
the squad leader again. Cassian tried to refocus as the stormtroopers approached the trio. They kept their weapons out, maintained a tight formation, demonstrated all the discipline Imperial soldiers were supposed to. As one retrieved two sets of stun cups, the others watched Jin, Cassian, and the droid. K2 was babbling now.
"That's okay. If you could just point me in the right direction, I can take them, I'm sure. I've taken them this far."
Jin looked to Cassian and reached for her truncheons as the trooper with the cuffs approached. Cassian shook his head.
"Wait for a chance,"
he mouthed. And Jin looked ready to bite as the trooper snapped the restraints into her wrists. A few seconds later, Cassian too was cuffed.
"Hey," he murmured. "Hey, droid, wait a second."
Whatever the trooper's suspicions, they clearly didn't believe K2 had been subverted. If Cassian could make his intentions known, the droid could locate them in holding, access the Imperial database to free them. It wasn't a good plan, but it was a plan.
"Take them away,"
the squad leader called. The stormtroopers circled and moved in unison. Cassian felt a rifle muzzle nudge at his back.
"You can't take them away,"
K2 protested.
"You stay here,"
the squad leader said.
"We need to check your diagnostics."
"Diagnostics? I'm capable of running my own diagnostics, thank you very much."
"Don't argue,"
Cassian wanted to snap. He gave the droid as intent a look as he dared, but K2 was too invested in his debate with the squad leader. A stormtrooper shoved Cassian from behind, and he stumbled forward. If they were taken captive, and K2's reprogramming was discovered, then they truly had no way out. They could claim they were residents of Jeddah City, but that would fall apart on a cursory investigation. They could say they were deserters from Saul's band, but they'd gain no leniency.
You messed up bad,
Cassian told himself.
This time, you get to pay the price yourself.
Then a voice cried out, steady and commanding, and everyone, stormtroopers, captives, and droid, stopped to look.
Let them pass in peace!
Chirrut Imwe stood in an archway, staring at the stormtroopers with blind eyes. Jin wanted to laugh. Cassian had called him a guardian of the wills, whatever that really meant. He'd played games with Jin to try to buy her necklace. And now he was what? Martyring himself? Maybe he was more zealot than con man after all.
Let them pass in peace, he said again, leaning lightly on his staff.
The stormtroopers were repositioning themselves, fanning out to defend against Chirrut or another rebel ambush. Chirrut began chanting and the words throbbed in Jin's aching skull.
The Force is with me, and I am with the Force.
He emerged from the archway, stepped toward the stormtroopers. He was in the middle of the street now, separating most of the squad from Jin, Cassian, and K2SO.
And I fear nothing, for all is as the Force wills it.
Hey! Stop right there!
The squad leader's voice was angry. Not used to being ignored by civilians, Jin thought, and smiled grimly.
He's blind!
A second trooper called.
Is he deaf?
The squad leader asked.
I said, stop right there!
Chirrut raised 1 foot from the pavement, and the squad leader fired a single shot. It was too late to shout a warning, too late for anyone to intervene. And Jin felt an unexpected ache, a pang of guilt over the death of a man who had tried to save them. But Chirrut was not dead. The bolt had been aimed with precision, yet Chirrut was not dead. The merest twitch of his head, a glance to one side, had saved him and sent the energy flashing by toward the captives and over Cassian's shoulder. Stormtroopers who had previously hesitated to shoot a blind man adjusted their weapons with nervous hands and a renewed sense of duty. Jin shifted her wrists and her cuffs, glancing at the 2 stormtroopers who remained within her reach. Chirrut was inside the bulk of the squad in 2 strides. His staff was suddenly in motion, sweeping behind legs and twisting arms back unnaturally. Jin felt clumsy and graceless. Where she had thrown her whole body into every strike with her truncheons, Chirrut dropped stormtroopers with a delicate whirl, a flick of his wrist. He was mocking them now, in a voice full of gentle mirth.
Is your foot all right?
Like a dancer, he leapt a step to the side as another stormtrooper fired his rifle. The bolt found one of the trooper's squad mates, and Chirrut only shook his head sadly. The 2 stormtroopers by Jin were staring at the melee, as if debating whether to join their squad. Jin chose her moment and swung her cupped hands into the helmet of the trooper nearest. The metal bit fiercely into her wrists as she impacted. Graceless or not, exhausted and cold and hurting or not, she'd do what she could. She'd caught the stormtrooper by surprise. She took advantage of the man's shock by throwing her shoulder into his chest, forcing him to his knees. She heard Cassian and K2SO fighting too, heard continued shouting from Chirrut's direction, but she focused on her own opponent. She brought her shackles down on the back of the trooper's head, pounded at his helmet, drove him low, drove the plastoid against his skull again and again, until he finally slumped to the ground. If she'd been sure of his unconsciousness, Jin might have stopped there. Instead, she kicked him fiercely, viciously, 3 times, until she was certain he couldn't rise. Cassian and K2SO's opponent was down as well. Chirrut stood calmly over a pile of bodies. Jin rolled aching shoulders and felt blood on her raw wrists. But the fight wasn't over. A second squad of stormtroopers, reinforcements maybe, or just drawn by the noise, rushed in from the intersection. Chirrut was too far away to intercept them before they could take aim. Jin scanned for cover, saw none within reach, and prepared to drop flat onto the dust. She heard the crackling snap of a particle bolt, but none of the stormtroopers had discharged his or her weapon. One collapsed, then another, as sniper fire struck them faster than Jin would have thought possible. When the last was dead, the shooter emerged from across the way. Jin recognized him, Chirrut's silent partner from the alley, the one with wild hair and red armor. In one hand, he bore his repeating cannon. In the other was an ornate, gold-trimmed bowcaster at odds with his battered and practical gear. This, the man passed to Chirrut.
"You almost shot me," Chirrut said.
"You're welcome,"
his partner replied. Without looking, he fired a bolt into the back of a stormtrooper crawling nearby. Then Chirrut's partner turned toward Jin and Cassian. He raised his cannon, expression wary but not outright hostile. Chirrut watched with blind eyes.
"You both saved us," Jin thought. "You won't kill us now."
"Clear of hostiles,"
K2SO announced, striding forward to survey the remnants of the battle. Immediately, Chirrut's partner aimed at the droid. K2SO halted and amended.
"One hostile."
"He's with us," Jin cried.
"No." Chirrut spoke to his partner gently. "They're okay."
The red-armored man lowered his weapon again. Jin thought he looked disappointed. Jin nursed her scraped wrists and flexed her fingers, glad to be free of the cuffs. She'd spent too much time in restraints, gone to too much trouble to ensure her freedom. Even a few minutes was more than she wanted to endure. K2SO was freeing Cassian as Chirrut and his partner looked on.
"Go back to the ship,"
Cassian told the droid.
"Wait for my call."
"You're wasting your most valuable resource,"
the droid returned, but he strode away obediently. Jin looked to Cassian for an explanation. They were still in danger, and while the droid brought unwanted attention, he'd also proven useful. She didn't much like K2. He was still more reliable than their new allies. Cassian evidently had other things on his mind. He watched Chirrut's partner.
"Is he a Jedi?"
he asked, with the hushed doubt of a man on the verge of a great discovery. Jin thought of the spinning staff, of Chirrut's graceful dance of battle. Was that what Jedi were like? Her mother had told her stories. The mystic warriors and guardians of the Republic in the centuries before the Empire, believers in a force that guided living creatures. She never really believed in the stories. The Jedi, yes, but not the legend.
"No Jedi anymore," Chirrut's partner said. "Only dreamers like this fool."
Chirrut shrugged mildly.
"The Force did protect me."
"I protected you," his partner replied.
If Cassian was disappointed by his answer, Jin couldn't tell. She was willing to take Chirrut's partner at his word. Easier to believe in what existed now rather than what might have been long ago. She bit back her next words, savored the sour taste, before asking,
"Can you get us to Saw Gerrera?"
She'd already committed to the mission. Might as well see it through. Neither Chirrut nor his partner had the opportunity to reply before someone called,
"Hands in the air!"
Rebel fighters emerged from alleys and rooftops. Jin recognized several from the plaza. She wanted to shout in rage. For hours, it seemed, she'd done nothing but fight, and her body had been sapped of every erg of strength, had turned to nothing but a collection of bruises and aching muscles. Cassian was the first to drop his weapon. Jin followed suit. Cassian mouthed something to her. Not the enemy.
"Can't you see we are no friends of the Empire?"
Chirrut asked. He'd set his bowcaster in the dust. Even his partner had relinquished his cannon. One rebel stepped forward, a thin, skull-faced Tognath in leathers who breathed through a mechanical respirator and spoke in his native dialect.
"Tell that to the one who killed our men."
Jin looked to Cassian. In her mind's eye, she saw him fire his blaster in the plaza, felt the grenade explode over her head. She remembered the cold, guiltless sensation that had passed over her then. Shame found her now, gripped her heart, and she tore through it with anger. These were Saw's people. If Saw were alive, she knew how to deal with them.
"Anyone who kills me or my friends will answer to Saw Gerrera," she called.
The rebels shuffled, murmured to one another. One of them chuckled hoarsely. The Tognath cocked his head as if trying to recognize Jin's face.
"And why is that?"
he asked.
"Because Saw knows me," she said. "Because I know him. Because I was battling at his side when most of you were still crying in your beds instead of fighting back."
She'd begun by choosing her words carefully, but now they spilled from her lips unwanted. "I've seen that man at his worst. I know exactly what he does when he feels betrayed, and I'm still alive." The broken hatch made it easy to stumble upon unwanted memories. The battle in the plaza had already dredged up 100 bloody conflicts. She'd barely survived. 13 or 14 or 15 years old, and already trusted with a blaster. Now she remembered the looks from her fellow rebels, the whispers behind her back, the things they wondered about her, the things they believed.
"Because," she finished, "I am the daughter of Galen Erso."
The Tognath watched her for a long moment. Everyone, friend and foe, was still.
"Take them,"
the Tognath said. Two rebels grappled Jin. She didn't fight. Coarse cloth scraped over her nose, and she fought to breathe through the sack that clung to her face. She heard Cassian groan nearby, a growl from Chirrut's partner, and then Chirrut's own voice.
"Are you kidding me? I'm blind!"
Supplemental data. Pilgrims of Jeddah.
Document number DN4624. Faith and the Force of Others. Fragment excerpted from the archives of the Order of the Esoteric Pulsar. Author unknown.
What is the Force of Others? To ask this, you must ask one question and a thousand. To a cultist of the Hui Yui Tini, you must ask, what is the exhalation of the true amphibious god? To a Jedi, you must ask, what is it that binds and defines all life? To a child of the esoteric pulsar, you must ask, show me the secret pages of the Book of Stars. To a faithless man, you must ask, what power enables prophecy and sorcery in a world controlled by logic and law? These thousand questions will garner a thousand answers, all pointing toward the same truth. Now ask, where is the Force of Others? And one answer becomes inevitable. The kind and cold moon of Jeddah. For 1,000 faiths see truth in Jeddah's mysteries, no matter that their stories differ. No matter that not one history of the Temple of the Kaaba can explain each brick in its foundation. or that our legends entwine and part in paradox. I ask you to believe that Jedi is a nexus for faith, life, and the force of others in all their forms. If the force can be embodied in a vision or a living creature, why not a place? Or why not an idea? Why can pilgrimage not be Jedi, and Jedi not be the force? I ask you to believe this not because it is true, but because it is a beginning. Imagine these things and you must conclude that every visit to Jedi is a pilgrimage, that every visit to Jedi is an expression of faith and a search for truth, intended or not. When a thief comes to Jedi to prey upon the vendors in the markets, she does so in accordance with her nature. She will trick and lie and steal. And if she does not trick or lie or steal, then her faith and nature are altogether different. You say, why a thief? Why such a cynical conjecture? To which I say, do you not wonder why the guardians of the wheels protect their temple so? Why the Jedi carry their cruel swords of light even here? It is because our pilgrimages are in accordance with our faiths, and faith can bring terrible conflict. A thief is but the kindest example I can offer. Jedi does not give answers to those who do not know what answers they seek. Jedi does not bring into harmony those things that cannot harmonize. Jedi does not express faith and the force through its pilgrims. Pilgrims express faith and the force through Jedi.
Pilgrims express faith and the force through life. For what is life but pilgrimage? And what is life but conflict? There have been worlds and tyrants who have tried to prevent their people from journeying to Jedi, but such a thing cannot be stopped. Living beings will always find their way to the kind and cold moon, as they always have. Through the Force and Jedi, they will act as they must, for good and ill, and we will know them by their actions there.
Chapter 5. Cassian was blind beneath his hood, but although he lacked Chirrut's preternatural senses, he knew how to listen. During the long march from the Holy City, he listened to his captors. He listened to the code words they murmured to unseen allies who granted them passage out of the settlement and into the desert. He listened to their confusion, the short-lived cheering and then the grim silence, as the Star Destroyer above Jedi shrank into the twilight sky. He listened to the Tognath state coolly.
Saw will know what it means.
He listened to Chirrut's endless chanting. May the force of others be with you. May the force of others be with you. Muffled by the cloth sack, the combined effect seemed simultaneously profound and absurd. Most of all, he listened for Jin. He listened for her struggles. He listened for her voice. He tried to determine which steady tread on the sand was hers. For all Cassian heard, she might have vanished from the face of Jedi. Was it concern that made him fixate on her? His mission was to find Saw, and through Saw, find the pilot. Find proof of an Imperial weapon that could mutilate the galaxy. If possible, he was also to find and eliminate Galen Erso, a man very likely culpable in that weapon's creation. Jin was first and foremost a means of finding Saw. She'd already served that purpose, which meant she was now expendable. She dominated his thinking nonetheless. Cassian believed neither pity nor pragmatism explained it. He had sacrificed Tivik without hesitation. Maybe it was the need he'd seen in Jin the fire that had carried her through the fighting in the Holy Quarter. It seemed obscene to leave that need unanswered, abandoned to the dust. It was late into the night when the band left the desert for the rocky slopes of a mountainside, then on from the mountain to the echoing corridors of a stone shelter. Cassian recognized the heavier tread of Chirrut's partner at his side and risked a low murmur.
We're half a day out. The shrine.
A monastery, the man said. The catacombs of Kadira. Down among the dead.
The name meant nothing to Cassian. He tried to count rebel voices in the distance, but he rapidly lost track. They'd reached a base of some kind. Weapons clattered and heaters hummed, and heavy doors opened and slammed shut. Shouts of triumph and the click of wooden game pieces suggested the presence of bored guards or off-duty soldiers. Without prelude, Cassian's hood was torn off and a solid kick delivered to his lower back. He pivoted in time to see the blurred shadow of a cell door slam shut. He blinked furiously to adjust to the dim light. The cell was little more than a cramped alcove in the rock. Chirrut and his partner shared the space with Cassian. The former man chanted softly, "May the force of others be with you," in one corner, while the latter stood with arms folded across his chest, staring into the darkness of the cavern beyond the door. Jin was missing.
"Hey!" Cassian called. He rushed to the bars, cried out, "Jin Erso! Where is she?"
No one answered.
"You're a fool," Cassian told himself. "They won't talk to you, but they'll try to spot your weakness."
He mollified himself with the dubious pleasure of inhaling musty air unencumbered by a hood. The walls of the catacombs were inlaid with humanoid skulls, thousands of them, from what had to have been generations of monks, and draped with power cables leading from generators to heaters to comm stations. A handful of rebel guards sat on squat stools nearby, not far from where the group's gear had been splayed on a table. Other cells neighbored Cassian's own, silent and dark. He turned his attention to the door itself and pushed himself against the bars to peer at its outer control panel. The lock was mechanical, but wired into the systems of the rebel hideout. He could definitely reach it, suspect that he could pick it, but not without triggering an alarm.
"You pray?"
Chirrut's partner asked. Cassian turned to find the man speaking to the still chanting Chirrut.
"You pray,"
the man said and barked a laugh. He glanced at Cassian.
"He's praying for the door to open."
"Pray I get a chance to work,"
Cassian murmured, but both men seemed to ignore him. Chirrut stopped his chant abruptly.
"It bothers him," he said, "because he knows it is possible."
Chirrut's partner laughed again. The sound was brief and ugly, but Chirrut only shrugged and told Cassian,
"Bayes Malbus was once the most devoted guardian of us all."
Bayes Malbus. Cassian ran the name through his mental database and came up empty.
"Now he's just your guardian?"
he asked. Neither man took the bait. Cassian ran his hands over his face, scratched at his beard. Both of the guardians were formidable fighters, to be sure, and Chirrut, Jedi or not, half-mad or overzealous or sincere, was an echo of an era the Empire had nearly erased. Even the leaders of the rebellion rarely spoke about the Jedi. Had men like Chirrut been common, men so certain in their faith that they wielded it like a shield? Men so disciplined that, even blind, they could down a dozen stormtroopers with nothing more than a stick? How many people were alive to remember? Before the rise of the Empire, Cassian would have considered the Jedi his enemies. But he'd been so young, too young to understand who he'd been fighting or who he'd been fighting for. Now the Separatists were as forgotten as their Jedi foes.
"Why did you save us?"
he asked.
"Maybe I only saved her,"
Chirrut said. Cassian grunted. I'm beginning to think the Force and I have different priorities.
Relax, Captain, Chirrut answered. We've been in worse cages than this one.
Yeah? Well, this is a first for me.
There is more than one sort of prison, Captain, Chirrut said. I sense that you'll carry yours wherever you go.
Baze laughed again, but there was no boisterousness this time, just a coarse, hollow sound. Cassian frowned and turned back to the lock in the cavern. It was some minutes later that he realized no one had told Chirrut he was a captain. Jin recognized the soldiers in the monastery, though she'd never met most of them. She knew their scars, the burn marks on their palms from overheated blasters, the short, jagged lines on cheeks and neck drawn by slivers of shrapnel. She knew their carriage, the proud, compact manner they maintained that readied them to take or return a blow. She recognized these things, recognized the soldiers not only as rebels, but as Saw's rebels, trained in his image. And she instinctively mirrored their posture, reflected their mistrustful glares. All these years later, she was still one of them. And they hated her for it. She couldn't really blame them. They were mourning casualties in the holy city because of her. They were mourning their brothers and sisters dead at her hand, or close enough. She waited in the central chamber of the monastery, a place stacked with cots and cook stations attended by Saw's people. The Tognath had left her there after guiding her away from Cassian, her hood off and her hands bound. The question of where Cassian might be now was no more than a distant distraction to Jin, like the sound of a rat scuttling along rafters. She had other concerns on her mind. Saw Gerrera was somewhere close. She could almost smell the oil in his favorite rifle. For years, she had anticipated, fantasized about confronting him, picked hurtful words and braced herself for the wrath of the first, last, and only true warrior to stand against the Empire. That confrontation had never come, and she'd let the fantasy die. Now she wasn't sure she was ready for the fight.
I remember you.
Jin turned to see a woman approaching. She was pale, almost chalk-skinned, but human, dressed in an armored jacket two sizes too large. Her speech was slurred. One of her arms hung limp.
Were you on Fashender Prime?
The woman asked, as if trying to place an acquaintance.
No,
Jin said and furrowed her brow.
Must have been after my time.
Jin tried to recall the woman's face and caught other memories instead. She saw comrades she hadn't thought about in a lifetime.
Is Staven still alive?
Jin asked. Staven, who'd lectured her for hours one night for miswiring a detonator. Staven, who'd given Jin her first sip of fermented bantha milk and let her sit with the adults telling dirty jokes before anyone else.
No,
the woman said.
What about Kodo?
Kodo, who taught Jin how to swim in the mud hole they'd called a grotto. Kodo, who tried to kiss her, and who wouldn't talk to her after she refused. In response, the woman lifted her good hand, put an imaginary blaster to her head, and pulled the trigger.
Maya?
Jin asked, but that was stupid. She remembered now. She had been there when Maya died. Jin had been the one to inherit and promptly lose Maya's synthskin gloves, the gloves that had been so soft and smelled like carbon scoring. People didn't talk about the dead much among Saw's rebels. It made it easy to forget when someone was gone. The woman grunted and drifted away. The Tognath emerged from a doorway and returned to Jin's side. With a swift, unkind motion, he cut the bonds around her wrists.
He'll see you now,
the Tognath said.
No more distractions,
Jin thought. Saw Gerrera had recruited hard soldiers and made them heartless. Staven and Kodo and Maya, everything Jin had loved and hated about them, all of it was shadow in Saw's fiery light. She shut down a tremor and steeled herself to meet the man who'd saved her from the cave.
In there,
the Tognath said, and gestured at a curtained doorway. Jin stepped through the ragged fabric, which parted like a cobweb. The Tognath did not follow. The small chamber beyond was a Spartan living area built for a lonely abbot. It peered onto the valley of the holy city through a window in the rock. A pale gray dawn had crept up behind the horizon, and Jin realized that she was no longer tired. Sometime during the night, during the march across the desert, she had lost the capacity for ordinary exhaustion and taken on a deeper weariness. She heard a harsh metallic clank. She shifted her weight instinctively, ready to take a fighting stance.
Is it really you?
A hoarse voice asked. She was ready, she told herself. Jin turned her head and looked at Saul Guerrera. The wreck that had been Saul Guerrera. Where she had once known a soldier, scarred but strong, now she saw an old man, held together by the scaffolding of armor and braces. His dark hair was frosted with white, grown wild and unkempt about his face. His eyes were keen as ever, but they were trapped inside a rusting cage. Saul Guerrera had been the strongest person Jin had ever known. Even sealed within the hatch in her mind, buried in the darkness, he had shouted to be heard. She loathed him for so many reasons. She had been prepared to fight. Witnessing him like this, she wanted to cry.
I can't believe it, he whispered. Jin!
He strode toward her, the metallic rhythm of his leg echoing in the chamber. Might be quite a surprise, she said. She spoke in the voice of the Jin who wanted a battle. It was the voice of a soldier, the voice that terrified prisoners and demanded cold, merciless retribution. It was supposed to be Saw's voice, but there was no harshness in his rasp.
Are we not still friends?
He asked. The last time I saw you, Jin uttered, as casual as if she were butchering a rat on a spit, you gave me a knife and loaded blaster, and told me to wait in a shell turret until daylight.
I knew you were safe,
Saw said. He sounded wounded. You left me behind.
You are already the best soldier in my country.
Saw shook his head.
You were ready, and I saw that, even if you did not.
Her words came too fast, too hot. I was 16.
I was protecting you.
Her error seemed to give strength to Saw. His rasp became sharper, a swift slap of correction.
You dumped me,
Jin sneered, but it wasn't much more than a murmur. She had come full of savagery, ready to pit her fire against his. Instead, he'd stolen her heat, and all either of them had now was embers.
You are the daughter of an Imperial science officer,
Saw said. He spoke more gently than Jin could bear.
People were starting to figure that out. People who wanted to use you as a hostage. Not a day goes by I don't think of you.
Stop, she said. She didn't want this. The kind Saw Guerrera, the gentle Saw Guerrera, who could afford to look at the girl he raised and pity her. Fight me, she wanted to beg. Then Saw's eyes narrowed and Jin caught a glimpse of the warrior she knew.
But today, of all days,
he asked. He took another step forward, stared at her, unblinking.
It's a trap, he said. Isn't it?
What?
The soldier was somewhere in the wreck of the man, inside the armor and the braces, gasping defiance against his dying body.
The pilot,
Saw said with impotent urgency.
The message, all of it.
He grasped at the oxygen mask built into his armor, pulled it to his face, and sucked in a mouthful of air before resuming.
Did they send you? Have you come here to kill me?
There was no humor in his voice as he added,
There's not much left.
Jin shook her head slowly. The words drifted like motes of dust, like ash, and she began to comprehend. This was still the Saw Gerrera she knew, albeit enfeebled and drained of life. This was the man who knew compassion, who cared for Jin as his own daughter. Only so long as there was no battle to fight, no paranoid fantasy of traitors or imperial plots to lure him astray.
I don't care enough to kill you, Saw, she said.
So what is it, Jin? Why come to Jeddah in the name of the Rebel Alliance?
He'd done his research, apparently. He wanted to talk about her mission, about the pilot.
Fine. The Alliance wants my father, she said. They think he sent you a message about a weapon. I guess they think by sending me, you might actually help them out.
Who sent you?
He asked, as if he'd caught her at a lie.
Was it Draven?
General Draven, Mon Mothma, the whole damn council, Jin snapped. I don't know them, Saw. I'm doing this job because I have to.
Saw turned away, snatched up a cane, and leaned heavily against it. His hand was trembling.
So what is it that you want, Jin? Did you expect I could welcome you back? Ignore the deaths in the city?
She almost laughed. She held it in, smiled bitterly instead.
I want to be left alone. They wanted an introduction. They've got it. You should be talking to your prisoners, not me.
Again, that distant, distracted thought of Cassian. I'm out now. The rest of you can do what you want. The cane wobbled in Saw's hand. She saw him lurch, catch himself.
You care not about the cause.
Jin tried to find words to respond.
Do you think you're testing me? Do you think I've been hiding anything from you?
The cause, she finally managed. Seriously?
You were the best soldier in my country,
Saw hissed.
Not because of your skill, but because you believed.
The cane rose and snapped back to the floor, the sound bellowing through the room.
Because you knew our enemy like I did. Because you were willing to die for our cause and our army.
She had believed. Saw was right about that. But that belief hadn't been preserved in the dark cave in her mind. It had withered there, dried and cracked and turned to dust.
The Alliance, she said, the rebels, whatever it is you're calling yourself these days, all it's ever brought me is pain.
Saw's throat worked with effort, his nostrils flared. He didn't reach for the oxygen mask.
You can stand to see the Imperial flag rain across the galaxy?
He asked. Jin shrugged. She could have walked away then. Turned her back on the shadow of the man she'd known, walked into the desert and called an end to her obligations. But Saw had hurt her.
It's not a problem if you don't look up, she said.
She had seen Saw Gerrera face disloyalty before. She had seen him spill blood over worse offenses than her own, seen him bind and blindfold a would-be deserter and toss him from an airspeeder in front of an Imperial barracks. She knew, too, that he had hidden the worst from her. Secret methods of torment and interrogation that he hadn't wished to show a 15-year-old girl. She wanted to hurt him. She wanted his old fire back, in the hope that it might rekindle her own. She had come into his chamber prepared to fight and found herself suffocating, her rage perishing without fuel. The exhaustion of the night's trek, of the battle in the Holy Quarter, rose to reclaim her after all.
You taught me to survive.
But Saw only took a drag from his oxygen mask and closed his eyes. The trembling of the cane ceased. When he looked at her again, he seemed to have found a new clarity.
I have something to show you, he said.
So much could go wrong, Orson Krennic thought. But in the moment before action, in the instant when both triumph and defeat remained possible, the galaxy seemed wondrous. He observed the evacuation of Jeddah on a dozen viewscreens across the Death Star's overbridge. The smaller craft, the personal shuttles of high-ranking officers and the transports of specialized stormtrooper units were the last to lift off. The Star Destroyer Dauntless, once stationed above Jeddah City, had already repositioned itself some distance from the moon. Despite the protests of local garrison commanders, the forces assigned to Jeddah would be safe from whatever followed. One of the bridge officers called out a number. 97%. Krennic amended the thought. 97% of Jeddah's assigned military forces would be safe. That would suffice. Jeddah was a meat grinder. A 3% loss in return for total victory would win any general a commendation. It's past time, Director. The unctuous voice came from the direction of the turbolift. Krennic pivoted on his heel and smiled a broad, respectful smile at Willef Tarkin as the old man eyed the bustle of officers and technicians.
I couldn't agree more, Krennic said and inclined his head. But under the circumstances, it seems only respectful to await the Emperor's command.
The Emperor is awaiting my report, Tarkin retorted.
Krennic's smile faded only a touch.
One had hoped that he and Lord Vader might have been here for such an occasion.
Tarkin's voice was laced with irritation and feigned exasperation.
And I thought it prudent to save you from any potential embarrassment.
My embarrassment or your own?
Tarkin's objective was transparent. The man believed, with typical grandiose certainty, that a demonstration on Jeddah would diminish rather than enhance Krennic's stature. Yet why remained an open question? Krennic had turned up no evidence of sabotage, nor had his contacts close to Tarkin revealed anything of use regarding the governor's plot. And while Tarkin's disdain for Krennic was supreme, he would surely have arranged for the Emperor to bear witness if he assumed Krennic's incompetence would result in the station's failure. No. The most likely possibility was that Krennic's precautions against sabotage or failure had shaken Tarkin's confidence. The man was now hedging his bets. If Krennic succeeded in annihilating Jeddah, Tarkin would attempt to take credit in the eyes of the Emperor. If Krennic failed, all the better. But Krennic would not fail. The Death Star was ready. Once Jeddah was destroyed, he would receive his private audience with Emperor Palpatine, and he was confident he could persuade the Emperor that it was he, not Tarkin, who deserved the accolades. It even happened to be true.
Your concern is hardly warranted, Krennic said. The finest scientists and engineers in the Empire have dedicated their lives to this project. You will not find our faith in them misplaced.
If saying it would only make it so, Tarkin murmured, just loud enough for the officers to hear him above the din.
Krennic barely withheld a snarl.
All Imperial forces, he announced, striding along the command stations, have been evacuated, and I stand ready to destroy the entire moon.
The officers faced him, uniformly at attention. The technician slowed, but did not cease working, as Krennic had earlier instructed.
What we do today was once inconceivable. A scientific heresy. Yet our Empire and our Emperor have ensured our success and granted us the moral authority required to take this step toward peace. The death of a world.
He stopped at the sound of brisk applause from Tarkin.
Inspiring, he said. But that won't be necessary. We need a statement, not a manifesto.
Krennic's smile twisted into a grimace.
What is it, he asked, that you suggest. Tarkin shrugged. The Holy City will be enough for the day.
Krennic tugged at his gloves, felt sweat on his palms as his ire grew. His assessment of Tarkin had been incomplete. The old man was hedging against both success and failure, ensuring that even a perfect performance would be unspectacular at best. Could he subvert Tarkin's orders, arrange the destruction of the moon regardless, and claim that the station's sheer power had been unanticipated? He glanced from a control console to Tarkin and back. Not with him watching. Not on short notice. He would find another way.
Target Jedha City, he snapped. Prepare single reactor ignition.
Krennic concealed his resentment, calmed himself with the sounds of his breath and the tidal rush of the station reactor. This wasn't how he'd imagined the culmination of 20 years' work. A diminished attack, a Grand Moff's power play. But it was the reality he contended with.
Fire when ready.
His voice was steady. He had earned his pride, no matter the outcome.
Chapter 6 Cassian had a plan. He tested the cell door's locking mechanism while the guards were fixated on a game of Dejarik, pressing against the metal with his thumb and probing the limits of its tamper alarm. He'd feigned fatigue, leaning against the door's bar so he could inspect the lock visually and find its make and model. He'd mentally cataloged the picks hidden in his boot and selected the tools he intended to use. He guessed he could escape the cell in under 3 minutes. As soon as the guards were gone, anyway. But the guards weren't moving, and now he was stuck with two thoughts he had no desire to dwell upon. Had killing Saw Gerrera's people ruined any chance of reconciliation with the Rebel Alliance, even against the threat of a planet killer? And where was Jin? Who's the one in the next cell? Cassian tore his eyes from the guards and glanced over to Chirrut. It was the first time the blind man had spoken for nearly an hour. Baze grunted and shuffled to his feet.
What? Where?
He crossed the alcove, lightly shouldering Cassian aside to make room at the door. He peered into the darkness of the cell across the way. All Cassian could see was shadows. But Baze pulled back abruptly, snarling.
An Imperial pilot!
Cassian scowled and leaned in, trying to see what Baze saw.
What pilot?
Imperial.
Baze shrugged, squinted, seemed to assess the distance between himself and the ragged pile Cassian was starting to discern.
I'll kill him.
Cassian tried to interpose his body between Baze and the cell door as the guardian straightened with purpose.
No, wait! Damn religious crazies.
He wasn't sure what Baze could do from behind bars, and he wasn't keen on learning.
Back off!
He tapped the larger man's chest with his hands, tried to seem insistent without starting a brawl. Baze shoved Cassian once, but then returned to his corner, slumping to the floor. Cassian crouched at the bars. The ragged pile shifted awkwardly. Shadows crystallized into limbs, hair, a dirt-encrusted face, and a battered uniform with Imperial markings on the arms. The man didn't seem to see Cassian, staring between his knees, huddled as if in fear of the dark and the cold. Even from a few meters distant, he stank of sweat and filth.
Is this what Saw does to prisoners? Is this what he's doing to Jin?
Are you the pilot?
Cassian called. The man didn't look up.
Hey! Hey! Are you the pilot?
The shuttle pilot.
The man blinked. Cassian watched dim lights from the guard's chamber gleam in wet eyes. Then the man made a noise, a groan, that Cassian had trouble interpreting as a word.
Pilot!
Chirrut spoke softly.
What's wrong with him?
Cassian shook his head and tried to recall the words of the Imperial holograms in the city.
Bodhi Rook?
He asked. The man squeezed his eyes and shrank back.
Cassian swore to himself. If he's broken, he's no good to us anyway. Galen Erso.
Cassian tried. He tried to sound gentle, but he heard urgency slip into his voice.
You know that name?
The man hissed, turned his cheek as if he'd been slapped. His breath picked up, swift and loud like a hound's panting.
Cassian held still. Come on.
The man opened his eyes again. His breathing slowed.
I brought the message,
he said.
I'm the pilot.
Then, in surprise and horror and hope,
I'm the pilot! I'm the pilot!
Saw Gerrera clenched one trembling hand around the edge of his console. The other hand moved assuredly, inserting a hollow chip into the comm unit and tapping in a command.
This is the message from the pilot,
he said.
For what it's worth, he believed it was real.
Jin's throat seemed to tighten. She rocked half a step backward as if to withdraw from the chamber. She hadn't wanted to see Saw. She didn't want to see this. For reasons she couldn't justify, she stood still and watched. The hollow projector flared, and a man she didn't recognize appeared etched in sapphire light. He was gaunt, but not haggard, like someone dying under the gentlest of care. And his eyes looked beyond the recorder instead of at it. His face stirred something in Jin she couldn't verbalize, some primordial recollection warped by the weight of years. When he spoke, she knew his voice.
Saw, if you're watching this,
Galen Erso said,
then perhaps there is a chance to save the Alliance.
The words had the air of a deathbed confession.
My father is alive. My father is a coward. My father is a bastard. Galen Erso is not my father. Galen Erso didn't raise me.
Jin wanted madly, childishly, to rush to Saw's side, to cling to him for protection. She wanted to drive her fist into the hollow projector, to bleed from shards embedded in her knuckles, and then tear the hollow chip out, crush it under her heel. She stood and listened.
Perhaps there is a chance to explain myself. And though I don't dare hope for too much, a chance for Jin, if she's alive, if you can possibly find her.
He trailed off, shook his head briskly.
Chance to let her know that my love for her has never faded, and how desperately I've missed her.
From the ruin of the hatch, from the cave in her mind, came images, sounds, scents. Jin's father holding her, declaring, I love you, smelling as sour as his imperial uniform. She wanted to shout at the hologram, your love? Who gives a damn about your love? You sent me to Saw. You let my mother die. You did this to me. She didn't say anything, and the recording kept speaking.
Jin, my stardust, I can't imagine what you think of me. When I was taken, I faced some bitter truths. I was told that, soon enough, Krennic would have you. He toyed with me that way. For months he would pretend to forget you, and then act in conversation as if he'd slipped up, make mention of a new lead on you or so. Part of me longed for those mentions. I realize now it was a kind of torture. As time went by, I knew that you were either dead or so well hidden that he would never find you. But I knew if I refused to work, if I took my own life, it would only be a matter of time before Krennic realized he no longer needed me to complete the project.
He spoke these words swiftly, almost slurring them in his haste. In the silence that followed, his mouth worked noiselessly. Then he began again.
You may think that's an excuse, but I was fearful and should have died. In the interests of objectivity.
Here for the first time he smiled. It was an ugly, effortful thing.